This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. A new Showtime series called Masters of Sex will premiere in September. It's based on the book about sex researchers William Masters and Virginia Johnson, written by our guest Thomas Mayer, who's also a consultant for the series. Masters and Johnson became famous in the 60s for their groundbreaking and controversial research into the physiology of human sexuality. Instead of just asking people about their sex lives, Masters and Johnson actually observed volunteers engaging in self-stimulation and sexual intercourse. Changes throughout the volunteers' bodies were measured with medical equipment. Until Mayer's book, Masters and Johnson's research techniques remained shrouded in secrecy, but he was able to uncover information through interviews with their friends, family, and former colleagues, as well as extensive interviews with Virginia Johnson. She died last week at the age of 88. This interview covers sex research and gets into birds and bees territory you may not have explained to your children. So, parents, use your discretion. Let's start with a scene from the pilot of the Showtime adaptation of Masters of Sex, in which William Masters is explaining to Virginia Johnson that he wants her to assist him with his research. She's been working as a secretary in his OBGYN office, knows nothing about his sex research, and is surprised to see him carrying a handful of girly magazines.
I hired you because I need an assistant,
and because I suspect you might have a gift for the work. That said, if you're uncomfortable with what I'm doing here, speak now and I can make other arrangements.
I'm not sure what it is you're doing.
I'm wiring Mr. Mello to monitor pulse, heart rate, and brain waves to illuminate to my patients and to the general community what happens to the body during sexual stimulation and orgasm. The magazines are to help with the stimulation part because unbeknownst to me, Mr. Mello prefers women, which, to be frank, concerns me because it may, in fact, throw off my data.
Why would it throw off your data? Isn't an orgasm?
That is one of the many questions I hope to answer. But as she is my only subject, it really means I have no choice, whatever her orientation. So are you interested in the job or not?
Thomas Mayer, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe Masters and Johnson as having medicalized sex. Would you explain what you mean?
Sure. Before Masters and Johnson came along, the realm of sex, the subject of sex, was usually something that you talked to your priest, your rabbi, or your minister, or you found yourself lying on a couch talking about your feelings, about your mother, to a Freudian-trained analyst. Bear in mind, when they came along in the mid-50s, it was the height of Freud's impact on America. So they brought the realm of sex. They thought that the answers, the questions that people were posing and the answers that people were looking for were best addressed to a doctor who was well-trained in the subject of sex.
And they also used medical equipment to study sex. So just tell us a little bit about the tools that they used.
Well, Masters wanted to understand exactly how the body worked so that they could come up with therapies to fix the various different problems that married couples would have in the bedroom. So they used a variety of different instruments. One of the instruments that they used was to trace the breathing and the heart rates and such. There was also a device that was used to internally observe sexual response by women, and that had a nickname called Ulysses, but it was something that was all part of their clinical observation of how both male and females responded during sex.
Ulysses was basically like a large, clear plastic tampon that was attached to a camera so that you could see and monitor what was going on internally.
Yeah, in fact, there was a fellow who was an expert at the medical school at Washington University. Kramer Lewis was his name. And he was still alive when I was doing the research for the book. And he described how it was made of plexiglass. And it was quite a contraption, a little bit of Rube Goldberg there. But it was something that was quite effective. And eventually they would send the color photos to this lab at Kodak that basically dealt with medical schools and was accustomed to, you know, taking photographs of various different patients in the nude for a variety of different reasons. And they would get that back, and that's how they kind of traced this whole thing.
What are some of the breakthroughs Masters and Johnson were responsible for in our understanding of human sexuality?
Their major first book dealt with the power of female sexuality. Masters and Johnson really underlined the power of female sexuality. And in their long-term study, what they showed was that women had the capacity for multiple orgasms in a way that men would go into what they called a refractory period after having the initial sexual orgasm. Women were capable of multiple orgasms, and the second and the third was more intense than the first, and that they didn't necessarily need to have a man to have an orgasm. And this was something that was done with about 380 women and almost an equal number of men. And they recorded something like 10,000 orgasms over a decade-long study that formulated their major book, Human Sexual Response, that came out in 1966.
And you also wrote that they said that women could enjoy sex long after menopause, that penis size was not related to sexual adequacy.
Their empirical studies showed the power of female sexuality, and that their studies underlined that women had a much greater capacity for sex, and that this informed, it came along right along with the advent of the pill. It came along and kind of helped spark the feminist view about sexuality of the late 60s and the 70s. And you can see that Masters and Johnson's medical studies had a huge impact on people's understanding, the popular understanding of what was capable in the bedroom.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Mayer, and he's the author of the book Masters of Sex, about the sex research of Masters and Johnson and about the lives of Masters and Johnson. And that book is the basis of the new Showtime series, Masters of Sex. So it's kind of amazing to think that what they did was watch people in the act and record what was happening. He started doing this with prostitutes before he started recruiting people who worked at the university where he taught. Why did he choose prostitutes for his early research?
Well, that was really the only female subjects that he could get to study. He was going it alone initially. And, you know, Masters had a OBGYN practice in St. Louis where he was in many ways like the best doctor in St. Louis. He kind of had a lot of rich clients. So he was very aware that the experiences of prostitutes were different than everyday women.
One of the things that you say Masters learned by observing prostitutes at work was that they would sometimes fake orgasm to encourage
right.
the man to hurry up and finish. Right. And he was just amazed that that was a huge revelation to him. And that propelled his research forward in what way?
What happened with Masters is that he was using a number of different prostitutes. And one of the prostitutes was actually a graduate student, I believe. And he would debrief them after observing this and kind of talk about it. And he asked about orgasm, and she said, well, that she often faked orgasm. And he said, what do you mean, faking orgasm? And she said, are you kidding? Something to the effect of, buddy, you've got to be kidding. And she explained that virtually most women at some point in their life, if not almost every night, will fake orgasm. That, you know, is a common thing. And he seemed like he was struck by lightning, that the light bulb went off on his head. And it was this student, this graduate student, who said to him that he should get a female partner. And it was something that he really took to heart. And he realized that he was not going to go anywhere unless he had a female partner.
And he hired a woman who became his partner in research, and that was Virginia Johnson. How did he find her?
Well, Virginia Johnson was a 32-year-old woman, twice divorced. She was on the heels of her second divorce. She had two children, and she was going back to school, Washington University in St. Louis. She was essentially a secretary filling out insurance forms. She came along just as Masters was looking for a female partner. There were virtually no female doctors, and the few that were out there, they didn't want to go near this type of study. This was playing with dynamite. It was virtually career suicide. So Virginia Johnson, this woman going back to college looking for a degree, became eventually the ideal associate for Masters.
And at this point, Masters and Johnson started using not prostitutes, but, you know, volunteers, paid volunteers,
Sometimes, and sometimes just sheer volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Johnson was the exact opposite in many ways of Bill Masters. Masters was a hard science guy. Virginia was very good with understanding human beings, what made men and women tick, the emotional aspects of it. And that was part of her skill set that would prove to be very, very important to their work. And one of the first things that she did was able to convince nurses and graduate students and some patients and all the various different people in the St. Louis community to become volunteers in their study, essentially to drop their pants, if you will, all in the name of science.
When Virginia Johnson joined William Masters as his associate, you know, her job was putting the people at ease who are participating in the subjects, in the research, preparing them, making them understand the, you know, medical and scientific importance of the work that they were doing. But she became more and more an active participant in the research. And then at some point, Masters basically says to her that he and she should be engaging in sex with each other as part of their ongoing research.
Yeah, I was really shocked by
that. What was the proposition that he made to her, and what was her reaction?
When they began their studies, it was very much the power situation between them was that Bill was the big boss, Bill Masters, and Virginia was the secretary, who was very desperate to keep the job. And so what happened was, after a few months, their laboratory studies was almost like that Frankenstein lab where you see everybody's hair all jumping up out of it. There was a certain kinetic energy coming out of this lab. And what he theorized, what he said suggested to Virginia quite improperly, was that there would be a transference. He actually used a Freudian term, that there would be a transference if they didn't act out the sexual energy, and that the best way that it could be channeled was among themselves. And it was something that she kind of admitted somewhat reluctantly, was told to me by another associate initially, and then she confirmed it. And it was something that was... It underlined that the beginning of their relationship, their professional and personal relationship, was quite uneven. He was in the power position. He was the boss. And if she didn't say yes, in a sense, she would, one, not only not have a job tomorrow, but that she was beginning to really love this work and that it would be over tomorrow. She didn't agree to Bill's requirement that they have sex together. From this beginning began a very complicated relationship in which it became more and more equal. And that's probably one of the most fascinating aspects of their relationship. On this very inauspicious beginning began a much more equal relationship. And that Masters, a doctor who would probably be most, like most doctors, would be unwilling to give equal billing to a secretary, one without a degree, that he was willing to do that is one of the most paradoxical and ironic aspects, particularly when you think about the beginning of their relationship.
Well, also they went on to be married, although we'll talk about the marriage a little later. It didn't sound like the greatest marriage in the world. But, you know, so when he makes this proposal to Virginia Johnson that they should be having sex with each other as part of their research, did he intend to, you know, like measure their responses and treat their sexual encounters as part of the research?
I gathered that was part of it, you know, how things would work. But I also think it was the entree for their relationship, or at least their sexual relationship. And, you know, indeed, it became an affair, a full-fledged, very hot-to-trot affair there over a number of years, on and off, And Virginia had her own life. Bill maintained his marriage out in the suburbs, his wife and his two children. And often the way in which their average day, if you will, would work was that he was an OBGYN by day. And then after hours, they would have the sex studies that would take place. And then after that, they would sometimes go off and have sex themselves. And that was kind of their relationship for a number of years at the outset.
Eventually, Masters and Johnson married. And what's your understanding of why they got married?
Well, they got married at the very height of their fame. They were on the cover of Time magazine, and this was about 1970. And by that point, they had become quite world famous. Virginia Johnson had made more money, frankly, from somewhat to a surprise to her, than she ever imagined. And she had met a man who had funded, a millionaire here in New York, who had provided money for their study about the impact of scents and smell on sexuality. This was a guy who provided the lemon and lemon pledge and all these various different scents. And he felt that, you know, somehow they found the link between scents and sexuality, that this was well worth funding. And it turned out, as much as Masters liked that idea, he didn't like the idea that this fellow, Hank Walter was his name, wound up having an affair with Virginia Johnson, and that eventually Virginia wanted to get married to Hank Walter. When Masters found that out, he finally decided that he was going to end his marriage, that the thing that was most important to him was not his family, was not even necessarily the relationship with Virginia. It was that work that they were doing, the brand name of Masters and Johnson. And so Masters ended his long marriage, told his kids that he was divorcing their mother, and got married to Virginia.
Some of their later work was very controversial, not because of the techniques that they used, but because a lot of people just thought it was out and out wrong. And one example of that is their 1979 book, Homosexuality in Perspective. What was most controversial about that book?
Well, they had developed a therapy that was remarkably successful. They claimed an 80% success rate among people who would come to their clinic for 2 weeks and miraculously were changed, that they had whatever problems, sexual problems they had, were somehow dealt with and if you will, cured. That 1979 book dealt with the subject of homosexuality. And a lot of the book dealt with homosexuality in the same way that they had documented in their first book with heterosexuality, just exactly how things worked and such. But Masters insisted on pushing the envelope, if you will, by suggesting that their therapy with a handful of cases had been able to help, quote-unquote, convert homosexuals into heterosexuals if the patients wanted to do this. Now, in doing the research for this book, I came across the understanding both from Dr. Robert Kolotny and then eventually from Virginia Johnson herself that there was no proof of that, that handful of cases, there weren't files on that. And that when Dr. Kolotny asked Bill Masters about it, he said, well, he insisted on it that it happened, but there was no proof. There was a lot of back and forth, and Masters prevailed, and it went into their book, and it caused a great deal of mischief because it became one of the things that a number of different usually right wing folks would say that homosexuals could somehow convert to heterosexuality if they really wanted to, because Masters and Johnson, among others, had insisted that it would be possible if the patient really wanted to do that. And of course, it caused a lot of heartbreak, a lot of difficulty for people in the years after that book appeared.
And they also wrote in Homosexuality and Perspective that sexual orientation was a learned behavior. Implying that you learn to be straight or gay, and implying after that therefore you could unlearn being gay.
Yeah, you know, I think you have to look at that book also in its time. Bear in mind They were on Meet the Press for the entire half hour or hour of that program back in 1979. And you had the leading medical writers at the time quizzing them about it. And there really wasn't much in the way at that time of people contesting some of their theories, such as that about learned behavior or whether or not it was genetic. And so they have to some extent, be viewed in the time period in which they operated. They were still very much pioneers. Their work, particularly their early books, was so easily documented. And Masters, you know, some people have asked me whether or not he was anti-gay or such. And I don't think that's quite right, because in the early 70s, when homosexuality, believe it or not, was taken out of the textbooks as a mental disorder, it was Bill Masters who was one of those doctors who helped push that out of the textbooks. He was one of those people that helped make the world more progressive in their understanding about homosexuality. I think it was more hubris on his part, that certain arrogance about the success rate and their willingness, his fundamental nature of being a risk taker, saying that he believed in their therapy so much that this might be possible, that they could, quote, convert homosexuals into heterosexuals if they really wanted to. It's quite unfortunate, particularly as we look back on it.
I'm going to ask you a question that I imagine a lot of people asked about Masters and Johnson, or maybe particularly Masters, who initiated the research, even when they were at the height of their fame, and that is, do you think that part of his reason for doing this sex research is that he was a bit of a voyeur?
Maybe. If you delve deeply somewhere into his psyche, I wouldn't be able to say with certainty. I don't think so, though. The way he started was as a medical student studying anatomy. And there was something even more appealing than any realm of sexual titillation. It was ambition. That's what fueled Bill Masters. He was somebody who had been, who felt he wanted to show that he could make something of himself. He was a risk taker. And I think it was sheer ambition, raw ambition, that drove him, that tantalized him more than anything else here. I think that's what really was at the heart of his drive. He learned about it as an anatomy student and realized that perhaps he could win a Nobel Prize. So it was his raw ambition, I think, that drove him to do all of this.
Thomas Mayer is the author of Masters of Sex, which has just been published in a new paperback edition. The Showtime series based on the book premieres in September. Though he's now 77, Woody Allen hasn't slowed down. His latest movie, Blue Jasmine, stars Cate Blanchett as the ex-wife of a convicted investment securities tycoon who goes to live with her sister, played by Sally Hawkins. The cast includes Alec Baldwin, Louis C.K., and Andrew Dice Clay. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Another year, another Woody Allen picture, and few agree on whether that's a good thing. For some, he hasn't made an interesting film since Husbands and Wives, maybe even Hannah and Her Sisters. Others think more recent morality plays like Matchpoint and comic parables like Midnight in Paris prove the old dog still hunts. I'm in the middle. I'm amazed he makes films like Blue Jasmine seem fresh and lively when he works in such a closed creative ecosystem, in which no music seems to have penetrated his consciousness in any meaningful way since the jazz of the 50s, no theater since early Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, and no movies since Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers in 1972. More damaging to his work is his congealed worldview. Long ago, Allen concluded the universe was godless, justiceless, and meaningless. The best we can do is eke out our hopeless lives with, as he titled one of his movies, Whatever Works. Here's what still works for Allen: filmmaking. He continues to refine his technique. His movies are lighter, leaner, more fluid. Blue Jasmine is sour and derivative, but he sells it beautifully. He does read newspapers and in interviews expresses strong opinions about the unscrupulousness of Wall Street titans. In Blue Jasmine, he makes his protagonist a kind of younger Ruth Madoff, wife of swindler Bernie, and sets her down in an updated A Streetcar Named Desire. Cate Blanchett plays Jasmine, once wealthy and ensconced in New York society, now broke, and forced to travel to San Francisco and live with her working-class sister Ginger, played by Sally Hawkins. They were adopted, and there's quite a gap in their styles. When Jasmine isn't insulting Ginger's blue-collar boyfriend, played by Bobby Cannavale, she swallows tranquilizers and goes in and out of fugue states, babbling to anyone and no one, while Alan whisks us back in time to life with her ex-husband, played by Alec Baldwin. I don't think Alan identifies with Jasmine the way Tennessee Williams did with Blanche. He clearly hates her. She didn't know her husband was defrauding investors, but only because she didn't want to, not with shopping and Pilates and all those charity events. Calamity hasn't made her a better person. As she lies on a couch opposite her sister, she still can't face reality.
Didn't I hear Eddie say he knows a dentist looking for help?
Oh, forget it. Jesus, it's too menial. I go nuts. I want to go back to school. I want to get my degree and become, you know, something substantial. I can't just do some mindless job. Oh, I was forced to take a job selling shoes on Madison Avenue. Oh, so humiliating. Friends I'd had at dinner parties, our apartment came in and I waited on them. I mean, do you have any idea what that's like? No, one minute you're hosting women, and the next you're measuring their shoe size and fitting them. Erica Bishop came into the store. She saw me. Was so embarrassed for me. She slipped out thinking I didn't see her. I saw you, Erica!
That Blanchett played Blanche DuBois on stage is a mixed blessing. I found her too theatrical, too external. I wanted a grittier actress. But Blanchett does carry scenes that would trip up a less able performer, and she's a terrific physical comedian. In flashbacks, when Jasmine is living high, her posture, the up-tilt of her head, the precision with which she holds her designer purse, is amusingly studied, as if she trained to be an Upper East Side trophy wife. If you know Alan's work or A Streetcar Named Desire, you can predict almost every turn and twist of Blue Jasmine. But Alec Baldwin and Michael Stuhlbarg as a schnooky dentist and Andrew Dice Clay as Ginger's ex-husband add deep and surprising shadings to their stereotypes. And you can never predict Sally Hawkins, best known as Poppy in Mike Leigh's Happy-Go-Lucky. She's Blanchett's opposite, raw, goosey, spontaneous. Her best scenes are with a persistent suitor, played by Louis C.K., a sensitive actor, even with lines he didn't write. But I wish he'd rewritten them. They end at the point where, in his own TV show, Louis, they'd mushroom into something more poetic and cringeworthy and revelatory. In interviews, Louis has said he'd like to co-write a film with Alan, and I say, go for it. I don't think Alan is too old to relearn what in his best work he showed artists like Louis C.K., that even ordinary people have the capacity to transcend their worst instincts and awful surroundings, and that you don't have to settle for whatever works.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with actor John Gallagher Jr. In the HBO series The Newsroom, Gallagher plays Jim Harper, the senior producer of the nightly cable news program anchored by the Jeff Daniels character Will McAvoy. But Gallagher isn't just an actor. He can sing and dance. He won a Tony in 2007 for his performance in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening, and played Jesus of Suburbia in the original Broadway cast of the Green Day musical American Idiot. The Newsroom is now in its second season, which is set during the 2012 presidential primaries. Ever since the start of the series, Gallagher's character Jim has been in a will-they-or-won't-they relationship with one of the young producers on the new show. And right now, it's looking to him like they won't. In an attempt to get away from the woman who's broken his heart, Jim decided to go on the campaign trail and report from the Romney press bus. But he discovers there's nothing to report, just repetitive stump speeches and daily spin delivered by Romney campaign aides. In this scene, Jim tries to get some real answers as the Romney aide delivers the daily spin. The aide speaks first.
At our next event at Rollins Park, the governor's message will be simple and clear. He'll be reiterating his role as a business leader and job creator, and he'll focus as well on the failures of Obamacare to meet the needs of the country. Jim.
I'd like to read you the email you sent us last night. At tomorrow's event, the governor's message will be simple and clear. He'll be reiterating his role as a business leader and job creator, and he'll focus as well on the failures of Obamacare to meet the needs of the country.
Is there a question?
Okay, Governor Romney said we can't reduce our debt without changes to the entitlement programs. Mm-hmm. What changes is he proposing?
He's laid out his plan.
No, he hasn't.
Go to our website.
I'm there right
now.
You
can read about our plan.
There's no plan.
Current seniors would have nothing to worry about. We made a promise to our parents and our grandparents,
and that's a promise
we need to keep. Okay, I get it.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't think you do, because while those are sentences and everything, they're not a plan.
If we don't figure out how to stop spending and cut this debt, we'll be leaving a terrible burden to our children.
There's no one who disagrees with that. What's the governor's plan?
Obviously, we have to look at entitlement reform.
Okay, good. What kinds of reforms?
That's all laid out in the governor's plan.
Are you a cyborg?
Are you a moron? You think you're scoring wise-ass points and he's plainly with you. You've heard the only answer you're gonna hear. Learn how this works, because you're driving the rest of us crazy.
You can't blame me for trying.
I am. I'm blaming you for trying.
Any other questions?
Can I get 30 minutes with the candidate today?
No. Anything else?
Lunch will be
turkey sandwiches.
John Gallagher Jr., welcome to Fresh Air. As we heard in that scene, a lot of Aaron Sorkin dialogue is filled with comebacks and retorts, and it's like volleying back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get a scene like the one we just heard, how do you rehearse it?
It's hard, because it usually most of the rehearsal happens when I'm alone, you know, at home in my apartment. I'll work on the scenes. I'll walk around. I'll try to say them out loud. Sometimes I'll record myself saying all of the lines, even the characters that aren't mine, and I'll listen to that while I'm doing dishes or cooking dinner or doing something else, just so that I'm trying to get it into my head in a way that doesn't feel like work. I've always been able to listen to a song, you know, once or twice, and then kind of know all the lyrics. And so I find sometimes getting, you know, audible cues in my head will help me learn it in a way that I'll go to, you know, rehearse it again, and all of a sudden it'll be in there, and it'll start being a little bit more effortless. Because the truth is, we don't have a lot of time to rehearse with each other. You know, that scene which you heard, which is kind of lengthy and verbose alone, that I think was one of four or five scenes that we shot that day. So you have to kind of compartmentalize and learn a lot for one particular day. And you only really get a couple of times to rehearse them with your co-stars. And so day one, I think, of season one of The Newsroom, one of the things Aaron Sorkin said to us, he said, you know, if you the more rehearsed and prepared you are when you show up in the morning, the happier and more confident you're going to be about your performance. And it wasn't a warning. It was just something that said, hey, you know, I think I've done, you know, these shows. And shows like The West Wing and Sports Night Studio 60, they had longer seasons than we did, because he'd never done a show for cable before. So they used to have to do 22, 23 episodes. We do 10, and it feels like climbing a mountain. And so when he said that on day one, I thought, okay, that's something I'm going to have to pay attention to.
So I like the idea of you doing all the parts, recording them and playing them back as if it was a song, because it's easy to memorize the lyrics of a song. Did you come up with that approach yourself?
I think I had heard once or twice about actors doing that. I find the easiest thing to do is doing it with someone else. But I always feel guilty trying to track down a friend to come over and help me learn my lines all the time. So I figured I was going to have to find out a way to do most of the legwork myself. And that's where I had heard about actors making recordings of the lines and listening to them. And it was something that I tried. I think one of the first times I even tried it was for my audition. because I remember I had a couple of really lengthy scenes for my first audition when I first went in for the show. And I tried it and found that it worked in a way where it was helpful because it was something that I could rely on when I didn't have a scene partner. Because the repetition is really what's important, I think, when you're learning like big, you know, stretches of dialogue.
So since you're doing other people's parts when you're learning this way, are you ever surprised at their line readings because yours were different?
I mean, it's more like, if you ever heard any of them, that it's more like a bunch of zombies reading Aaron Sorkin dialogue. I try not to put any spin on how I'm going to deliver it. Usually I'll just kind of just read it kind of monotone without a lot of inflections or affectations. I just don't get the words in there. And then once the words are in there, it's not really until I get on set that I start doing it with the other actors once or twice, a couple of camera rehearsals and blocking rehearsals. And that's when I think the intention and, you know, what you really want the character to be saying, what he's trying to get from someone else, that's when that starts to emerge, because then you start to work off the other actors and what they're bringing to the table suddenly informs the way that you want to you know, play volleyball with them kind of in the scene. Not a literal game of volleyball, but, you know, verbal Aaron Sorkin volleyball.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Gallagher Jr., and he's one of the stars of The Newsroom. He plays Jim Harper, who is, as we speak, on the road with the Romney campaign. He's just gotten thrown off the bus, actually. And he got a Tony for his performance in Spring Awakening on Broadway and was also the star of American Idiot, the Broadway adaptation of the Green Day album. So I thought we should listen to you singing from the cast recording of Spring Awakening. You open an ensemble song called The Bitch of Living. Do you want to introduce it for us?
Yeah, this is a moment in Spring Awakening, the musical. I think that kind of sets the tone for what kind of show it's going to be. It's about these repressed teenagers in 19th century Germany, and this scene starts with a group of kind of frustrated schoolboys in Latin class, and you realize that my character is a bit of the class screw up, and he can't get any of the translations right, and he gets chewed out by his teacher, and then this song immediately starts, and you start realizing that it's actually going to be modern rock music is going to be the kind of the canon of what's going to help push the story forward, and so this is my character having an outlet to all of his teenage frustrations.
And this is John Gallagher Jr. from Spring Awakening.
God, I dreamed there was an angel who could hear me through the wall. As I cried out like in Latin, this is so not life at all. Help me out of this nightmare, then I heard her silver call. She said, just give it time, kid, I come to one and all. She said, give me that hand, please, and the itch you can't control. Let me teach you how to handle all the sadness in your soul. Oh, we'll work that silver magic, then we'll aim it at the wall. She said, love may make you blind, kid, but I wouldn't mind at all.
That's John Gallagher Jr. and the cast of Spring Awakening, the original cast from the cast recording. You've spent time on television now. You know, you're in a regular series. You've also done several Broadway shows, including two hit musicals. Can you describe some of the differences for you being in a TV series in which there's hardly any rehearsal and you're learning new lines for each episode? You're learning what happens to your character as it happens. You really don't know in advance. Compare that to one of the plays or musicals that you do where you're doing the same thing every night.
Yeah. You know, plays and musicals, aside from the major difference being that you do them for a live audience, and when you do a film or a television role, you're doing it long before the audience is really going to see it, and your audience really is the camera when you're working on those. But also, you know, in plays and musicals, you'll get a wealthy period of rehearsal, and you'll get a wealthy period of being able to try things and have them not work, which is your preview period, where you'll do a couple weeks of performances where you can still change and alter and rewrite and try new things before you open the show. And And then you have it, you know, you get it in a rhythm and you get it all memorized up front, and then you run it and then you just perform it as is. There is room for little, you know, shifts and your performance might change, but, you know, your dialogue is going to stay the same. And it's interesting because, you know, Aaron Sorkin will start writing for the actors. He'll pick up on little strengths or little things that he likes about our characteristics, you know, individually, and we'll start kind of catering to that, or even maybe trying to push against that to get us out of our comfort zone. But one of the hardest parts really is just the memorization, memorizing a lot of dialogue, a lot of new dialogue every day, and then letting it go for the next day to learn the new scene. But one thing that's great about TV is you at least get a weekend. You know, when you're doing theater, you get 24 hours to recover. You get one day off most of the time doing plays. And it can be very hard to recover in 24 hours. Doing TV, getting just that extra day, getting those 2 days off, like, feels like just a massive luxury.
When the cast recording for American Idiot came out, I interviewed Billy Joe Armstrong. And I want to play you like an excerpt of that interview about translating Green Day music onto Broadway. So here's Billy Joe Armstrong in 2010 with me. One difference between the Broadway versions of your songs, I think the Broadway singers enunciate more clearly
That was a big deal when we're, you know, being a rock singer, I can get away with a lot, you know, because most of the time people don't know what the hell you're saying anyway. That's why we have lyric sheets, you know.
And there's a long tradition of that in rock.
Yeah. And then, but the tradition, you know, we're in the studio with Michael Mayer. And
he's
and
the
Tom
director.
Who's the director, and Tom Kitt's the arranger. And when they were listening to the singers, they were saying things like who, you know, can you please, I can't hear the T in this particular word. And we were looking, you know, like I can hear it fine, you know. It's no, you know, but that's just the difference between theater people and rock people, I guess.
I bet no one has ever said to you, I can't hear the T.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
So that was Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day in 2010. So John Gallagher Jr., when you were starring in the Green Day musical American Idiot, was there somebody telling you to enunciate your T's more clearly?
Oh, definitely. Michael Mayer is become such a dear friend, you know, family almost, doing those two shows, doing Spring Awakening and American Idiot. But you know, he's a bit of a he can be a taskmaster, and he would come to my dressing room all the time with things that were acting notes, things that were about conveying emotion, and things that were about, we just can't understand what you're saying. And I know you're out of breath. I know that you just did a 9.5-minute song with these crazy dance moves, but you have to, whatever it takes, whatever you need to do so that we can understand the first word of that verse. It's the first sentence of that verse, and we need it to be able to know what this song is conveying. So, yeah, he definitely had no problem telling me little things to clarify the dialogue and the singing.
Was there anything that struck you as odd translating Green Day songs into a Broadway show?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a natural fit from the first workshop. There's something so epic about that record, and so grandiose and thematic and universal, and so in that sense, it made sense. But one thing that was tough was finding a way to tell the story without having to bring in, you know, traditional scenes. We felt that it should move really fast. It should move kind of in a way that a rock concert moves, where sometimes songs will end and the next one will start immediately. And that's not a very musical thing. Usually the song will end and then there's a scene. And usually there will be a scene that'll be kind of about what the next song is going to be. And then that song will start. And you'll get the song version kind of the scene that you just saw. And so some of it can get a little redundant, a little repetitive. And we wanted to keep it moving. So we cut out the, you know, book scenes, and I would just kind of do these narrative poems sometimes that were kind of the way that the quote unquote dialogue for it. And then a lot of the challenge came between how do you tell a story without having that traditional book scene and without having traditional musical theater lyrics. So a lot of it came down to choreography and movement and lighting, and projections that we would put on the back wall and different ways of figuring out how we could convey the story and push the story forward in a non-traditional sense.
Why don't we hear you singing from the cast recording of American Idiot? So I thought we'd hear Jesus of Suburbia. Do you want to say anything about translating this onto Broadway?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was probably one of the moments where I thought, oh, this is something so cool. Because it's my favorite song off of the Green Day record. It always was. It's kind of – it's the one that is most suited to theatricality. It's about 9.5 minutes, and it tells kind of this big, great story. So it was one of the hardest numbers to work on, but one of the most rewarding, too.
Well, John Gallagher, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so this is John Gallagher Jr. from the original cast recording of the Broadway musical American Idiot.
I'm the son of raging love, the Jesus of suburbia, got the Bible.
That's John Gallagher Jr. singing Jesus of Suburbia from the original cast recording of the Broadway musical American Idiot. You'll find a longer version of Gallagher's conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.